Who's Talking is brought to you by University Square, a collection of locally owned high-end shops and restaurants offering unique products and free storefront parking. Visit University Square on Franklin Street, downtown Chapel Hill. University Square. See you there.
Now, here's D.G. Martin on WCHL.
Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. All right, Libya. How did the United States get into this, and how might it get out? Well, when I started thinking about that question, I said, well, I've got a guy. My go-to guy is Dick Cone, who's the professor of history and peace, war, and defense at Carolina. So Dick Cone has agreed to join me. But Dick Cone says the person we really should ask is his guest who came to Carolina for a seminar on how wars end. And that's Andrew Bacevich, who's professor of history and international relations at Boston University. He's also the author of a recent book, Washington Rules, America's Path to Permanent War. So I'm going to ask both of these guys, the question. And Dr. Bacevich, I hope I've said your name right.
No, Bacevich is correct.
That's good. Mm-hmm. Dick, let me ask you the question just to introduce it, and then maybe you can tell us a little bit about Andy as you respond to the question, how did we get into Libya and how are we going to get out?
Well, in my judgment, we got into Libya, I think, because of a change of heart and attitude on the part of the President of the United States, who suddenly realized after Gaddafi promised that he would kind of murder everybody who opposed him, that he might have a Rwanda on his conscience for the rest of his life. And I think he was persuaded of that by his Secretary of State, who was the President's wife when Rwanda happened, and his UN ambassador, who was Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs. And Libya is different than other Middle Eastern countries. And Gaddafi has attacked and killed Americans and sponsored terrorism and had a nuclear program. And the only other two countries really like that have been Iraq and Iran. And so here was an opportunity to get rid of this guy. There was not just demonstrations in the square, but there was an armed rebellion going on in his country that had seized territory. And here was a chance to prevent, in the president's mind, a massacre and also get rid of one of the worst bad actors, not only in the region, but in the world. And because we have this military capability, as Andy in his books has shown in the last dozen years, we have this capability. We think of this capability often first. We can use it for good reasons and not so good reasons in our national interest and what many think are in the world's interest. And he's been the leading voice and the most original, the most imaginative voice on foreign policy and military affairs, in my judgment, in the last 15 years.
Well, that's an interesting point. Let me just introduce Andy, and I hope you'll help as well, because I want to he has written in his recent book this. The folly and hubris of the policymakers who heedlessly thrust the nation into an ill-defined and open-ended global war on terror, without the foggiest notion of what victory would look like, how it would be won, and what it might cost, approach standards hitherto achieved only by slightly mad German warlords. Those are Andy's words, and when I read them again, I thought, well, is this, as you say, sort of a special case, or is this just one more launch into an ill-defined and open-ended part of a global war on terror?
Well, I mean, to my mind, it is. The Libya case is consistent with that quotation that you just read, albeit it's an intervention on a substantially smaller scale than, for example, Iraq or Afghanistan. I think everything that Dick said a moment ago is true, and one way to examine this case is to see it with reference to events like Rwanda and all the regret that people feel about that. But there's another way to frame it, and I think the other way to frame it is in the larger context of what U.S. policy in the greater Middle East has been all about over the past 30 years or so. So you could tell the story beginning with Rwanda, but I also think you can tell the story beginning with the promulgation of the Carter Doctrine back in 1980. By 1980, the Middle East, the Persian Gulf more specifically, has emerged as a vital U.S. national security interest, largely reflecting the presence of these immense oil reserves. Back in 1980, things are not going well. The Shah has been overthrown. The Soviets have invaded Afghanistan. There's a perception that the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan will be followed by further Soviet aggression threatening the Persian Gulf. And so President Carter commits the United States, in essence, to using military power to sort out the problems of the region in ways that we expect will be to our advantage. And to my mind, that began a project that has seen the United States go back to the military well time and time and time again with expectations that the adroit use of American power can sort things out. It hadn't worked out very well. We have, over the period of 30 years, spent an enormous amount of money. We've suffered some pretty serious human losses. We've sullied our reputation through various acts of misconduct. And it's hard to see at the end of that 30-year period of military activity that the region is becoming any more stable and any more peaceful. And yet, faced with this outburst of violence in Libya, in many respects, President Obama is simply going back to the same playbook and hoping that somehow this time we'll get a better result. So I do think you can look at it from the context of Rwanda. I think you can also look at it from the context of this many decades-long effort on the part of the United States to pacify, if you want to use that term, the region.
I think you have to do both. What I was talking about was proximate causes.
Yes.
I think Andy is absolutely right. And you also asked, how do we get out of there? And that, I think, is the greatest deficiency of the decision-making process of the Obama administration in the last 3 weeks. It's very unclear what the overall goal is and how to achieve it. The mission given to the military is very limited, but the overall goal is probably, it's obviously getting rid of Gaddafi, but it's probably some kind of regime in Libya. We know not, because we know not really who are the rebels and what their goals are beyond getting rid of Gaddafi. But I think the frame is absolutely right, Andy.
And the goal is, I think, getting rid of Gaddafi. There's uncertainty as to what level of force and what level of commitment is going to be required in order to achieve that goal. It seems pretty clear that we are moving down a path of escalation. I mean, the papers today report the fact that there are American covert agents, British covert agent, British special forces on the ground who, in one way or another, are attempting to assist the rebels. That certainly is a couple of steps beyond simply enforcing a no-fly zone, which is where we began. So there seems to be uncertainty about how we're going to get that job done. But beyond it, I think there's, to my mind, there's very little clarity about what is the larger strategic purpose that would be served by getting rid of Gaddafi. I mean, the moment that we live in is one that is extraordinary in the sense that there is so much going on in the Arab world. we think that some of what's going on is positive, that there are opportunities for Tunisia and Libya to perhaps, still uncertain, perhaps move toward a more liberal and democratic regime. There is significant unrest in places like Bahrain and Yemen and Syria, and we really don't know where that is headed and whether the outcome will be positive or negative. But you have to scratch your head and say, well, if all that's going on, how exactly does this U.S. and allied intervention in Libya connect to everything else? Are our actions in Libya going to promote a more positive outcome of this Arab uprising? Or could we potentially be derailing the Arab uprising if indeed this is perceived in the Arab world as the West once again mucking around in their business? Or is the intervention in Libya irrelevant to events elsewhere in the region? So to my mind, a big question here is, what's the strategic purpose? What's likely to be the strategic impact?
I think there's very little evidence, at least in the public prints, that the administration knows the answer to the alternatives and questions you've posed. I think that the administration in the United States is very much desirous of sending the message to its friends, who, after all, in Saudi Arabia and elsewhere, have helped us both combat al-Qaeda and contain Iran. Mm. We have been trying to tell our friends that they cannot act like Gaddafi. Mm. And we told that to Mr. Mubarak, but unfortunately, he made his own situation untenable. But I think that's the message we've been sending to the people in Bahrain and Yemen and Saudi Arabia and elsewhere. The joker in the deck now is Syria. But I think the as you've pointed out, the ability of the United States to really affect what's going on in this region is vastly overrated. Mm-hmm. And I think both by our by the American population, the American government, our allies, and by our enemies.
You know, I tend to think that the joker in the deck, or maybe a better term would be wild card, is Israel. When events first started to occur in Egypt, to my mind, there was a significant amount of reporting basically trying to figure out what will be the effect of big change in Egypt on the way Israel views its security situation. And I'm not reading every newspaper every day, but as the Arab uprising has progressed and spread, Israel's kind of dropped out of the news to a considerable extent. And they may have dropped out of the news, but I think the question still is a tremendously relevant one, because this upheaval, and again, it's an upheaval, the outcome of which we are unable to anticipate and I think unable to really affect in any significant way, could well have massive implications for the security of Israel. And they become the wild card in the sense that their perception of increased insecurity, Israeli insecurity, could lead them to act in ways that will catch us by surprise. Again, I don't think we have a lot of ability to go tell the Israeli government, do this or don't do that. But I do think, in that sense, they are the real, not the joker, but the real wild card.
Well, we're visiting with Andy Bracevich and with Dick Conan. We'll be right back after this short break.
Who's Talking is brought to you by University Square. It's locally owned, high-end shops and restaurants, and free parking on Franklin Street, downtown Chapel Hill. See you there.
Now, once again, here is D.G. Martin.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with our friend Dick Cohn, who's the professor of history and peace, war, and defense at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, because I came to him to find out, to get wisdom about what wisdom I could get about what's happening in Libya, how we got into it, why we got into it, and whether what our pathways to disengagement from Libya at the right time might be. He said, well, I just happened to have in town my good friend Andy Basevich, who's a professor of history and international relations at Boston University. Why don't I bring him? Because he might be able to help us wrestle with this. And if you joined us late, we have been wrestling with it. The comparison that I leapt to was our reaction in Egypt, where we sat back mostly and let the Egyptians sort out their revolution, even though there were times when it looked like there might be a brutal repression of the revolt or revolution or whatever it was. In Libya, we seem to have not been able to restrain ourselves from letting things work out. In Libya, we were impatient, and as Dick Cohn pointed out, we were unwilling to have people blame us for the loss of life that might happen if the rebellion in that case didn't succeed. But can we go in and rescue everybody every time that there's a good revolution or rebellion in some faraway place where people are going to get massacred? Is it our job to come prevent that?
Well, we can't, and we won't. I mean, I think that's where there's a certain amount. There's an effort being made to interpret the Libya intervention as establishing a new Obama doctrine. People are calling it that the United States the Obama doctrine would say the United States acting with allies will take seriously the so-called responsibility to protect and therefore intervene in circumstances when governments fundamentally fail to meet their responsibility to protect their own citizens. And in that, were that Obama doctrine to be effectively implemented, then the implications would seem to be that we better mount up and go intervene in the Ivory Coast, and that we better ask ourselves why we haven't been intervening in the Congo, where the failures of to fulfill a responsibility to protect have been blatant. As a practical matter, my sense is that we're not going to intervene in the Ivory Coast, and that, frankly, nobody will pay any attention to events that go on in a place like Congo. So I think that it's likely that the Libya intervention is not likely to be a precedent-setting event that will have a lasting effect on U.S. behavior. I think it's likely to be more of a one-off kind of episode.
I agree with that.
Dick Cohn talking.
And I tend to think, as I said, that Libya has this similarity to Saddam Hussein's Iraq and to the current regime in Iran, in that it's a trifecta of evil. This is a repressive a dictatorship that has attacked Americans. It is a state sponsor of terrorism beyond its borders, not just like Syria next door.
It is or was?
It was the current regime, Gaddafi, and it had a nuclear weapons program.
It had or has. I mean, all.
I don't know what its current behavior is, but as far as I could tell, Gaddafi has been trying to make nice since he realized we were going after Saddam Hussein. I mean, he began to make nice in 2003. So you have these three regimes in the Middle East, which the Carter Doctrine and oil, who have done these three things. You know, one down, one tottering, and one to go has been American policy.
Well, now, this, is this coming out of your mouth, or is this?
This is coming out of my mouth, which is hopefully connected to my brain.
Yeah.
And this is, as I see it, these are different regimes than the Saudis and the Yemenis and Oman and the Gulf states that have been trying to help us because they are Sunni and Iran is Shia and is Persian, not Arab. And that's the way the United States has been behaving for quite some time. We were concerned about Libyan terrorists when I was in Washington in the Pentagon in the 1980s. That's what began all these planters outside government buildings and barrel barriers in front of parking lots.
Let me jump in, and this is really rude of me to do this when I've got my expert, the guy that I go to, my go-to guy, is telling me where to go. I don't want to go there because this is my view about this, and then you all, I'm a student. You bring me around, but. Libya, to me, was a success story of American policy of patience and bringing kind of wild guys and corralling them without applying military force or committing American forces, but by patient acceptance of the imperfections of regimes that the countries have chosen to rule them and to bring them quietly into the international order. And then when the old guy dies, hopefully within the country, things happen in a better way. And that we were on the road to success with Gaddafi and Libya, I thought. But you don't, and that this whole thing of the applying a whole bunch of military forces to bring him down, we lose an orderly situation in Libya. We bring into a government either, I mean, hopefully it'll be much better and democratic, but it could be a Somali-type situation. Why am I out of order in worrying about arguing? You taught me don't let the establishment of a good situation, or don't let perfection be the enemy of establishing, you know, something that you don't have to worry about.
I'm going to defer to Andy in just a moment, yeah. But I'm going to answer this way. No one ever trusted Gaddafi. He's a madman and a murderer, and he promised to murder parts of his population wholesale. So I think we turned on that policy almost on a dime. But we were always, he was always in our crosshairs to some degree, and like the old boss Tweed of late 19th century New York politics, we saw as our opportunities and we're taking them.
I think I disagree with both of you to some degree. My recollection is that as you suggested, the rehabilitation, as you suggested, Dick, as the rehabilitation.
This is Andy Basefish. The
rehabilitation,
both of us.
The rehabilitation of Gaddafi occurs in the wake of the invasion of Iraq, and people in the Bush administration believed that the overthrow of Saddam had now put us in a position where we could basically bring this guy under control. I wonder if Gaddafi didn't have a different view. We thought we were playing him. I'm wondering if he didn't think, and perhaps was correct, that he was playing us. I mean, he had his country had been struggling under economic sanctions for a considerable period of time. Libya was listed on the State Department's roster of sponsors of state terrorism, oil infrastructure fallen apart. What I've read is that his nuclear program was going nowhere. You know, he had acquired a bunch of centrifuges or whatever, but he wasn't going to develop a nuclear weapon. And so he volunteers to give up his nuclear program, which had no practical value. And lo and behold, he's brought back into the fold. Taken off the State Department list, diplomatic relations with the West restored,
oil technology,
money starts pouring in to improve the. So who won here? He did.
Or maybe everybody did.
Well, maybe everybody did. But certainly the effect of that was not to loosen the grip of this tyrannical dictator, his grip on power. It was, in fact, to reinforce the apparent longevity of the regime. Now, the Libyan uprising occurs. We didn't start that.
That's for sure.
We didn't anticipate that. We didn't control that. It was simply a further expression of this larger Arab uprising. And now we do turn on a dime. And once again, the Gaddafi that we were at war with back in the 1980s is the Gaddafi of the present moment. And the process of rehabilitation, which supposedly was a triumph of American statecraft, has now been dumped down the memory hole.
I agree with Andy.
Let's take a break we could, and we'll come right back to Dick Cone's response. Andy Reisfish has corrected both of us respectfully, and we'll hear Dick Cone's response after this short break.
Who's Talking is brought to you by University Square, a collection of locally owned high-end shops and restaurants offering unique products and free storefront parking. Visit University Square on Franklin Street, downtown Chapel Hill. University Square. See you there.
Now, here's D.G. Martin on WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. We're talking about Libya, about how we got there, why we got there, what we can do right now. I've got two experts, my good friend Dick Cone, a professor of history, peace, war, and defense at Carolina, and his friend from Boston University, Andy Basevich, and we're having a great discussion. Dick, I interrupted you as you were responding to Andy Basevich's correction. He said both of us, but I think it was mainly aimed at me.
Well, D.G., what I was thinking when I responded to you earlier, and I forgot to say, is I think where I disagree with your interpretation is that the United States had much to do with bringing, as you put it, bringing along Gaddafi in 2003. In effect, we just agreed to his agreement to give up a nuclear weapons program going nowhere, to give up bad behavior and state-sponsored terrorism. And he, in exchange, as Andy has pointed out, he got a tremendous amount of advantages and things released, pressures released from him that enabled him to survive and even gain a degree of legitimacy that he never had before.
We should recall that one of the things that was gained was the release of the convicted agent held responsible for the Lockerbie bombing, released from a Scottish prison and returning home to Tripoli in triumph.
Right.
I mean, so you ask yourself, who's driving the train here?
Ironically,
who is reaping the benefit?
This is today's news is that the foreign minister of Libya, who negotiated and tricked our friends the British into releasing this criminal, has now defected and gone to Britain and is spouting out all of his secrets about Gaddafi. Mm-hmm. You think you understand who your friends are and who you can trust. This guy was Gaddafi's maybe number one confidant, mm-hmm. and now
outside his family.
Outside his family, yeah. But you guys, I appreciate your corrections. What do we do now? Do you see an end game, Dick Cone, for our situation in Libya? And I put it in the context of today's events, and maybe tomorrow will be different. But today it looks like we're succeeding a little bit on the internal breakup of Gaddafi's close-in group, but on the ground, he's still able to deliver disciplined troops who can beat the ragtag group of rebels who are untrained and really unarmed except for sidearms. We're going to have to go on the ground in some fashion, either with surreptitiously or somehow to provide the overthrow of Gaddafi, aren't we?
Well, the great flaw, I think, in what the United States has done in the last few weeks is not to figure out what the end game looks like and how to achieve it. This is liable to go on, in my judgment, for weeks and months. And if from the United States has committed its prestige, but a great deal more than its prestige, and it cannot allow Gaddafi to remain in power of a unified Libya. It could contain him if it does, but the United States would be, in my judgment, in a very weakened position in the Middle East, and a very dangerous and expensive situation were it to leave Gaddafi in power. We would have to have a no-fly zone there again indefinitely. And so in the end, I think if we can't negotiate Gaddafi out into some kind of exile, we are going to have to go in there and root him out.
So the cover was the humanitarian.
I don't think it was a cover, DG. I think it was an honest effort on the part of the administration, but I don't think I'm not. There's no evidence to me that they had actually thought this through completely and comprehensively. The problem with Iraq in 2003 was we thought it would be easy, quick, and cheap, and I'm afraid that old siren song has returned.
Yeah. I think, when you made reference to persuading Gaddafi to leave, I think that that gets to the heart of the matter. I mean, what is it that sustains the loyalist side in this fight? My guess would be it's Gaddafi, that either his personal charisma or more likely his ability to dole out money to persuade people to keep fighting is what sustains his forces. Take him out of the equation, good chance that the loyalist effort would collapse rather quickly. So how do we get Gaddafi out? The preferable way would be to make him an offer he can't refuse, some type of glorious retirement with a big bag of cash, and that would, to my mind, be a satisfactory outcome, or take him out involuntarily.
Maybe in Caracas. He'd like to live in Caracas. But I think also the outside community is going to have to promise the tribes that he's associated with and the people around him that there's going to be no revenge.
Yes.
There's going to be no retaliation for having been loyalist and fighting for him.
But back to Gaddafi, unfortunately, and I would imagine that people in the United States government and in Europe are, furiously exploring if there are ways to get him to agree to go. Mm-hmm. But from what we read in the press, he seems to be absolutely determined to fight on to the bitter end, and that's where, if that turns out to be the case, we end up with all these lousy options. The rebel forces do appear to be full of enthusiasm and not possessing much real wherewithal and ability. Well, should the United States and its allies build up those forces? That's no small task. Providing arms, providing training, providing advice, providing intelligence support, building an army that is in fact already engaged in a fight. That's the sort of scenario that does lead you to believe that, it could go on for weeks and months. That's going to cost a lot of money. In the meantime, yes, the no-fly zone would necessarily have to be enforced. And suddenly, the intervention that the president began, probably very much influenced by humanitarian concerns, persuaded by advisors this is going to be quick and easy, becomes long, hard, and costly. That's, I think, there's a real prospect of that.
And that's the template that has occurred to the United States.
Over and over.
Over and over.
I want to thank both of you, Andy Bacevich and Dick Kuhn, for your discussion of the Libyan situation. I'd like to take a break and then come back. And Dick, if you can prompt your friend Andy Bacevich to talk a little bit more in terms of the long-term situation in terms of the U.S. and its application of military solutions to world problems, I would sit back and try to listen quietly. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back after the short break.
Who's Talking is brought to you by University Square. It's locally owned, high-end shops and restaurants, and free parking on Franklin Street, downtown Chapel Hill. See you there.
Now, once again, here is D.G. Martin.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guests are Dick Cohn, our friend who's a professor of history and peace, war, and defense at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and his friend, Andy Basevich, from Boston University. We've talked about Libya. But, Dick, as you've told me pretty forcefully, that Andy Basevich has a very significant and important and well-respected viewpoint in terms of what's happening or what has happened to our country's policy as it relates to the application of military force sort of on a long-term basis. And I wonder if you could get him, if you could pose a question for him or a request to talk about that a little bit.
Well, I think Andy has very articulately here and elsewhere explained the consequences for American foreign policy of this, what he calls in one of his books, the New American Militarism. But I think even more of concern to him has been the domestic consequences of this behavior and the institutions that have grown up around it and the habits of thought in the United States and in the government, but in the population also. And I couldn't recommend anyone's books more forcefully than Andy's, American Empire, the New American Militarism, The Limits of Power, and now his newest, Washington Rules. So, Andy, maybe you talk about the domestic consequences of this.
We choose to be. We are determined to remain the most powerful country in the world in a military context. Broad consensus on that. We spend as much money on our forces as the rest of the world does put together. And that's not in particular a controversial sort of a notion. I think that the emphasis on military power, and I'm by no means a pacifist and want us to have a strong military, but I think the overemphasis on military power has not served us well in the way we've acted in the world. But as Dick suggested, I think even more important than that, this emphasis on military power as what we are about, what we do best, has tremendously adverse consequences here at home. And perhaps the real heart of the matter is the relationship between the American people and their military. We all understand that it has become almost a religious sort of proposition that we are obliged to express our support for the troops. I doubt that there are more than a handful of Americans who don't share in this admiration, expressions of admiration for those who serve. And in many respects, those expressions of admiration are entirely appropriate. But the fact of the matter is that the American people have largely become divorced from their military. It is admiration expressed at a great distance. And it is not an admiration on our part, on the people's part, that is willing to accept that we have a responsibility to ensure that those soldiers are not abused. I think our soldiers have been abused. I think that the notion that young Americans are going off for their fourth or fifth combat tour in the course of a decade of war, and that we, the people, basically think that's okay, that we find that acceptable, I think that that really does not speak well of us as a people. So the place to begin, to my mind, restoring good sense to U.S. policy, and the place to begin the process of backing away from this overemphasis on military power is to close the gap between the American people and the American army.
We just got a minute, but what are things we can do to close that gap?
Well, I think that, and of course, many people say, well, the answer is conscription. Let's have conscription. And to some degree, I think that would solve the problem, except that conscription is politically infeasible. Nobody wants conscription. The military, above all, is not interested in conscription. But I think that we can begin the process of closing the gap by creating incentives for the American middle class, broadly defined, to be more willing to send the sons and daughters of the middle class to serve, to make the military more genuinely representative of society as a whole. And when I say incentives, I mean material incentives. Dick teaches at a school at Carolina, which is a school that I think is probably one of the best bargains in higher education in the entire country. I teach at a school, which I am very proud of, and it's a wonderful university, Boston University. Probably costs about $52,000 to $54,000 a year to attend BU, tuition, room, and board. That's a huge amount of money. My proposal is every American who completes a term of service should be admitted, should be funded to attend any school that they get in, and that incentive could bring the middle class back into the military.
Well, Andy Bacevich, I know you're just getting started, and I've got to stop you because we're out of time, but Dick Cone, Andy Bacevich, thanks so much for sharing your wisdom about Libya and about long-term American challenges with our listeners here in Chapel Hill.
Thank you.
And thanks to all y'all for listening. This has been Who's Talking. I'll be right back here soon.